Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, if you just take a second and sort of feel into your own experience, right now, what's that background noise? For so many of us, I think the answer is this. This low hum of dread.
Yeah.
Almost.
Of anticipation, yeah.
We're always connected. We're swimming in this sea of uncertainty, scrolling through headlines that just, you know, they breed fear. And then you've got the digital inboxes that never, ever empty.
It creates what our sources for today call a chronic low-level state of alarm. And that's really what it feels like, right? An alarm that's just always on, quietly in the background.
It's exhausting our systems.
Completely. It's like you can never really drop anchor. Your nervous system, which is so perfectly tuned for survival, is just, it's perpetually mobilized. It's always waiting for the next thing.
And that next thing could be anything. It could be a global crisis, a work deadline.
Or just a sharp email.
Yeah.
But the body, it reacts pretty much the same way. It prepares for a threat.
Absolutely. So today we're doing a deep dive that looks at this modern epidemic of anxiety, but not just through the usual lens of psychology. We're looking at it through a really radical ancient wisdom tradition that asks a pretty challenging question.
And that question is this chronic fear just? Is it an inevitable part of being human?
Or is it fundamentally a byproduct of a mistaken identity,
yeah,
a misunderstanding of what we actually are.
Yeah. And to explore that, we've brought together sources that weave together these ancient spiritual teachings. We're looking specifically at the insights of the Upanishads and the 20th century teacher Nisargadatta Maharaj.
And we're integrating them with what modern science is telling us. Contemporary psychological and neuroscientific research, people like Stephen Porges, Candace Pert.
Right.
So the mission here isn't to find another coping mechanism. It's really to explore the possibility of a lasting, almost structural freedom from fear.
A freedom that the sources insist isn't found by trying to control the world around you. You can't. It's about fundamentally transforming how you perceive the world and, you know, yourself within it.
Okay, so to set the stage for all of this, we have to start with the central quote. The one from the Upanishads that really guides this entire deep dive.
It's revolutionary. It's simply, where there is other, there is fear.
And that is, it's so deceptively simple, isn't it? It doesn't say, where there is danger, there is fear. It says, where there is other. It points to separation itself.
Exactly. It just flips the entire script. It proposes that the root of our deepest anxiety, that existential dread, is the perception of being isolated. Of being separate.
So if the universe or the person next to me or even a part of my own mind is seen as other.
When it has to be defended against, there's an inherent threat. So if we can really get our heads around this idea of no other, then the very foundation that chronic anxiety is built on just, it dissolves.
So this deep dive is really for anyone who is just done with managing anxiety and is looking for that kind of permanent perceptual shift. Okay, let's unpack this. We should probably start with the basics. The crucial distinction our sources make between fear and its very pervasive modern cousin, anxiety. So first things first, the sources are really clear about distinguishing fear from anxiety. We tend to use them, you know, interchangeably.
We do all the time. But according to this framework, one is functional, even necessary, and the other is, well, it's often self-generated suffering.
Let's start with fear then.
Okay, so fear is simple. It's biological. It's an adaptive response to a specific, immediate, and identifiable threat right now.
Like stepping off a curb and a bus is coming.
Exactly. That spike of adrenaline, the whole fight, flight, or freeze response. That's fear. It's pure evolutionary programming designed to keep you alive. You need it.
So fear is localized. It's in the present moment, and it has a very clear protective function.
Precisely. Now, anxiety. That's where it all gets a lot more complicated. Anxiety is about what might happen.
It's future-oriented.
Overwhelmingly. It's sustained by memory, by rumination, and maybe most powerfully, by our imagination. The threat isn't actually here, but your body is reacting to a movie that's playing inside your head.
And this is where the modern science really comes in and validates this ancient idea, isn't it? Our sources talk about the neuroscience and how the same neural pathways are firing for both.
Yes. Your body literally does not know the difference between an imagined tiger and a real one. The amygdala, which is, you know, the brain's fear center, it gets activated either way.
But with anxiety, the trigger is cognitive. It's internal.
It's a thought, a persistent negative thought pattern, maybe a memory of a past failure, or you're just anticipating being rejected in the future. And when that thought-triggered response becomes a habit,
which it does for so many of us,
then the body enters the state of constant low-grade readiness. And that's the state they call hyperarousal.
That idea of hyperarousal is It's kind of terrifying when you think about how persistent it is. It means your nervous system is just stuck on high alert.
I mean, think of it like a smoke detector that's wired to go off every time you light a candle, even if that candle is miles away.
Eventually, it just stays on.
It just stays beeping all the time.
Yeah.
Psychologically, anxiety is what happens when the nervous system maintains that sustained state of alarm. It's constantly sending signals that your environment is fundamentally unsafe.
So deep down, the body has lost its trust in the world. It's lost its sense of inherent safety.
And that chronic state, it just drains your resources. It makes rational thought so much harder because your biological priority has shifted completely to survival and defense.
So the whole game then, whether you look at it psychologically or spiritually, is about restoring that sense of safety, physiologically and I guess existentially.
And to do that, we have to understand the dynamic between what our sources call reactivity and regulation.
Okay, so our nervous system has two basic states of operation.
Two primary states, yes. Broadly speaking, they are defense and safety.
Let's break down defense first.
Defense is all about the sympathetic nervous system. This is mobilization. Your heart rate goes up, blood flows to your limbs, you get that sharp tunnel vision alertness. It's designed for action.
It's pure reactivity. The body and mind are contracted, ready to deal with the other.
Exactly. And then, when we're not threatened, the safety state should be the default. And that's thanks to the parasympathetic system.
That's the rest and digest system.
Rest, digest, and heal. So regulation is really about cultivating the ability to shift back into that safety state, no matter what thoughts are just passing through your mind. You're building up a kind of physiological reservoir of calm that can override the cognitive alarm system.
And here's where the integration becomes so powerful, isn't it? The sources argue that these ancient contemplative practices, I'm thinking mindfulness, self-inquiry, breath awareness, they're not just, you know, spiritual hobbies. They're direct tools for nervous system regulation.
And what's so fascinating is that the spiritual goal, which is, you know, to stop identifying with the small, separate self, it has a measurable neurobiological result.
How so?
By training your mind to just return your attention to the present moment, maybe anchoring it in the simple feeling of your breath, you're actually disrupting that cognitive feedback loop that fuels anxiety.
So if the anxious thought is the trigger for the body's reaction, then interrupting the thought with presence should calm the body down.
That's it, exactly. And the science backs this up. When people do these practices consistently, you see a quieting of the amygdala, that fear alarm in the brain.
Right.
But you also see a measurable boost in activity in the prefrontal cortex. Those are the areas linked with emotion regulation, with higher order thinking, with compassionate self-awareness. It's a literal neurological shift.
So spiritual clarity, the realization of wholeness, is physically translating into a regulated nervous system.
Yes. Fear starts to recede because that feeling of separation, the one that demanded constant vigilance, is softening. And that allows the whole system to finally rest in safety.
Okay, so that really establishes the problem, this chronic, thought-driven hyperarousal that's based on a feeling of separation. Now, let's dive into the radical philosophical solution that promises to end this cycle for good. So we're coming back to that core insight from the Upanishads. Where there is other, there is fear. This feels much deeper than just worrying about a presentation. This is about existential dread.
This is the absolute crux of the spiritual teaching. Existential fear is that fundamental anxiety that arises precisely because the mind sees itself as this tiny, isolated, fragile thing, a me floating in this vast, indifferent, and maybe dangerous universe.
If I'm separate, I have to constantly protect myself.
From everything outside your boundary, which includes time, loss, and ultimately death.
So if the cause of fear is separation, then the solution has to be the realization of unity, of non-duality. But how does the philosophy say we should go about dismantling this deeply ingrained sense of being separate?
Well, the key is that fear isn't something you can conquer through brute force. You can't just fight it. It has to be understood as, at its core, illusory.
An illusion.
The realization of non-duality is simply the recognition that the boundaries we see between self and world, or observer and observed, they aren't fixed realities. They are conceptual constructs. They're just habits of the thinking mind.
It sounds very abstract, though. How do you get from that philosophical idea to the actual felt experience of wholeness?
The ancient method is a contemplative practice called neti. Neti. It translates beautifully as not this, not that.
Okay.
It's a process of really rigorous self-inquiry designed to shed all of your false identifications. The seeker asks, am I this body?
And the answer is no. The body is born, it changes, it dies. I'm aware of it.
Right. Am I this thought? No, the thought comes and goes. I'm aware of it. Am I this feeling of anxiety? No, that feeling arises and passes away. I am the awareness of it.
So you're systematically stripping away every temporary, perishable part of your experience.
You are. And by letting go of your identification with everything that's transient, your roles, your stories, your sensations, your thoughts, you're guided to what's left. The unchanging, stable, pure awareness, the consciousness that is the backdrop to all experience, and the source material asserts that when you can rest in that foundational awareness, the isolated, vulnerable me dissolves.
And in that pure awareness, there is no other.
Literally no other. And therefore, the very possibility of existential fear ceases.
But this must feel incredibly dangerous to the ego, right?
I mean,
if my whole identity is my job, my relationships, my history, and I start taking those away, isn't there going to be a huge psychological resistance to that?
Oh, immense resistance. The ego, that sense of a separate self, is built on those identifications. This is exactly why the practice has to be grounded, which goes back to the nervous system regulation we just talked about.
What?
Yes, because if you challenge those foundations too aggressively without that safety, you can trigger a trauma response. The philosophical insight has to meet the body's capacity to feel safe. But the promise is that the awareness you arrive at is infinitely more spacious and infinitely safer than the contracted self you were so busy defending.
Okay, let's look at how this insight was distilled into a more direct practice in the 20th century by the sage Nisargadatta Maharaj.
Right. Maharaj really simplified the whole human dilemma. He framed our entire life as being caught between two powerful binding poles.
And those are fear and desire.
They're two sides of the same coin of separation. Fear comes from a sense of fundamental insecurity and vulnerability. You fear loss, you fear pain, you fear non-existence.
And desire.
Desire comes from a feeling of fundamental incompleteness. It's that desperate need to fill the void with success or possessions or relationships. Both of them assume the same thing.
That you are a finite, lacking, separate entity trying to stabilize yourself in a world you can't control.
And if that underlying assumption is wrong, if I'm not actually separate,
then both the fear and the desire become fundamentally meaningless.
That's the leap. And Maharaj's instruction, it just bypasses all the philosophy and cuts straight to your primary experience. His central teaching was staggeringly simple. Just remain anchored in the simple, primal sense of being, the feeling that I am.
I can feel that right now. It's just the fact of existing. Before you add any labels.
Exactly. You don't attach the stories, the qualifications, the roles. You don't say, I am a worried parent or I am a successful executive. You simply rest in the pure knowledge, I am.
And that awareness is there before the body, before thought, before any identity.
By turning your attention back to that sheer sense of existing, you ground yourself in the only thing that's actually stable.
That's a powerful distinction. We usually define ourselves by the content of our lives, but he's telling us to look at the context, the space in which life is happening.
Because the content, your thoughts, your feelings, your circumstances, it's always changing. And because it's always changing, it will always generate insecurity. But the context, the awareness that knows the content, that is timeless and unmoving, by focusing on the I am, its vast, spacious nature is slowly revealed.
And he insists this isn't just a mental concept.
No, he says it is the truth of our being.
And the most compelling part of this, according to our sources, is the promise that this recognition can lead to an irreversible, permanent shift. I mean, that's a huge claim.
It is the ultimate promise of non-duality. It's not a temporary experience, like a little moment of peace you get in meditation.
Or some altered state.
Right. It's a fundamental structural realization of what you have always been. Once you genuinely recognize that this oceanic awareness is you, and the little wave of your temporary identity arises within that ocean, the contraction of separation can't be fully reestablished.
That background anxiety, that low hum of dread we started with.
It just dissolves. Its foundation is gone. You're no longer living primarily as that vulnerable, separate self.
So the world still throws challenges at you, obviously.
Of course. The external events still happen. But the internal reaction is completely transformed. Imagine you're afraid of your own shadow in a dark room.
Okay.
Once someone turns the light on and you see the shadow is inseparable from your body, the fear just disappears. You can't unsee it. That's the irreversible shift. You can't unsee the light.
And one of the reasons we can trust the validity of this path is that this insight, it isn't unique to the Upanishads or Maharaj. It's kind of the core synthesis across so many different traditions.
Yeah, you see the same trajectory described everywhere. They just use different words. In Zen Buddhism, they seek kensho, or satori,
which is that sudden seeing into one's true nature.
A breakthrough moment that's beyond concepts, and that true nature is fundamentally boundless.
And in Advaita Vedanta, which is the philosophical tradition the Upanishads came from, the goal is explicitly called self-realization,
which is the recognition of the identity between your individual self, the Atman, and the ultimate reality, Brahman. Same idea.
And even in traditions that seem very different, like Sufism.
The mystical branch of Islam, yes. They describe the same process. You move through fana, which is the dissolving of the separate ego self, followed by baqa, which is abiding in divine unity.
So the vocabulary is different, but the psychological mechanism is identical. Shedding the illusion of separation leads to the end of grasping and fear.
Exactly. The core synthesis is that fear and grasping are just reactions of a contracted self. When that perception of unity stabilizes, whether you call it unity or big mind or the I am, those habitual reactions of fear and defensiveness just, they naturally cease.
The vulnerability was never inherent in existing. It was built into identifying with a small, separate self.
You got it.
Okay, that gives us the profound theoretical solution, but how do we bridge that gap? It feels like we have this map for internal freedom, but how do we get from this high philosophy to the messy biological reality of our reactive bodies?
Mm.
So the sources are very, very clear on this. You can't think your way out of a body state. If anxiety is physiological, the solution has to engage physiology.
This is such a vital point, and it's often missed in purely spiritual or purely psychological approaches. William Bloom argues very persuasively that deep, chronic emotional pain, which often comes from trauma or sustained anxiety, you have to approach the body first.
And he cites Candace Pert's work on neuropeptides.
Yes, her pioneering work on those chemical messengers that translate our emotions into physical biochemical states.
So the feeling of sadness or fear isn't just a mental event. It's a tangible, measurable stew of hormones and peptides that are literally running through your system.
Absolutely. And if your body is saturated in those stress chemicals, no amount of rational self-talk is going to convince it that it's safe. You have to intervene physiologically first. Which brings us to Stephen Torges's polyvagal theory.
Right, PVT. It gives us the scientific language to describe what's happening in our nervous system.
Torges identified three core modes of the nervous system that dictate how we experience the world. They shape our thoughts and feelings long before our conscious mind even gets involved.
Okay, what are the three?
First, there's the safe and social state. This is governed by the ventral vagal complex. We're open, relaxed, connected, ready to engage. This is the goal state, really.
And so?
The threatened and mobilized state. That's your sympathetic activation fight or flight. Heart races, muscles tense, focus narrows, pure reactivity.
And the third state?
Is the traumatized and immobile state. The dorsal vagal complex. This is the freeze response. It's dissociation, collapse, burnout, a deep shutdown when a threat is just overwhelming and you can't escape.
This framework is so useful because it immediately shifts the conversation away from, like, a moral failing. Why can't I just calm down?
Right.
To a physiological reality, my system is stuck in mobilization or collapse.
Precisely. And this is the context where William Bloom introduces his concept of the fourth state. The first three states are automatic responses. The fourth state is the uniquely evolved human capacity to step back and witness those automatic responses.
It's the ability to observe the physiological stew, the racing heart, the shallow breath, the impulse to run, without immediately identifying with it, without being submerged in it.
Yes. So if the I am realization is the ultimate stable context, the fourth state is the practical tool we use to cultivate it in real time. It's that moment of choice between reacting and being present.
The fourth state is the bridge. It's recognizing there is fear in my body, but I am the awareness that is observing the fear.
And that process reinforces the understanding that the awareness itself is untouched by the churning chemicals. By cultivating this witnessing presence, you're engaging with the body's reality and reinforcing the non-dual truth at the same time. This is why freedom from fear requires skillfully engaging the body first. The stable witness needs a regulated body to operate effectively.
Now, this theme of separation, it doesn't just apply to the outside world, it applies to our inner landscape too. Our sources suggest that inner conflict, that exhausting feeling of arguing with yourself, that functions as many internal others.
If the Upanishadic principle is true, where there is other, there is fear, then internal fragmentation is a guaranteed source of chronic, low-grade anxiety and self-sabotage.
Every time we feel divided. The part of me that wants to relax versus the part that needs to be productive.
The part that craves intimacy versus the part that pushes people away. those parts are operating as separate defensive entities. And their conflict generates immense friction and fear. The anxiety comes from not knowing which internal other is going to grab the steering wheel next. We end up fighting ourselves.
Which is the most intimate form of separation there is.
It is.
So to bring these unconscious dynamics into the light, the sources introduce some really practical methods, like voice dialogue, developed by Hal and Sidra Stone.
Voice dialogue is an incredibly effective psychotherapeutic method for identifying and interacting with these subpersonalities. The core idea is simple, but pretty radical. You externalize the internal voices.
How does that work in practice?
The person will physically move to a different chair or a different space in the room to speak from the perspective of a specific part, like the inner critic or the pleaser or the vulnerable child.
And how does that physical movement help? Why not just talk about the parts?
By giving the part a literal voice and space, you do two critical things. First, you validate its existence and its protective intention, which instantly reduces its need to scream for attention.
Okay.
But more importantly, by stepping out of your default personality and observing the part, a witnessing consciousness automatically emerges. This witness is not the part. It's the space that can hold all the parts. And it's this larger self that can listen to the conflict without being consumed by it.
This sounds like a direct therapeutic application of the I Am principle. And it's connected directly to Zen practice through Jenpo Roshi's Big Mind process.
Roshi masterfully integrated the mechanics of voice dialogue with the non-dual aim of Zen. He uses that same method of giving voice to access what he calls transpersonal states, like big mind and big heart.
So by consciously speaking from the perspective of big mind, which is that boundless, fearless awareness, you get a direct experiential taste of non-dual awareness.
A direct taste. And the goal here is integration over suppression. You don't try to beat the anxious part into submission. That never works.
Suppression is temporary and just fuels more conflict down the road.
Right. The goal is to hold the fearful, difficult parts, those internal others, within the expansive field of your awareness, your big mind. When those fragmented parts are recognized as valid expressions of one underlying wholeness, their sense of threat just dissipates.
Inner fear softens. Conflict transforms into self-understanding.
And clarity.
That's a powerful transition from internal war to internal governance. Okay, let's talk about how this integrated perspective translates into a life lived out in the real world. So, if someone achieves this irreversible shift, and they're resting in that spacious I am or big mind, what changes about their actions in the world? Does that mean they just become passive? Our sources address this with the concept of karma.
Right. Karma, in its simplest form, is just the law of cause and effect. Every action, every thought has a consequence. And you often hear that an enlightened person is beyond karma. We need to be really careful about what that means.
What does being beyond karma actually mean here?
It means their actions are no longer rooted in the psychological drive of the separate self. They don't act from personal fear or grasping or attachment. Their choices flow from clarity and compassion instead.
So because there's no contracted me trying to anxiously secure its future?
The actions don't leave any psychological residue. There's no fuel for future suffering. The habitual fear-driven patterns just lose their grip.
But I have to challenge that a bit. If I'm truly free from fear and attachment, isn't there a risk that I'll become passive in the face of, say, suffering or injustice? If I see everything as unified, why would I bother trying to change anything?
That is the essential question, and the source material is very clear. Being beyond psychological karma does not mean ignoring real-world karma.
Okay.
The enlightened person is still fully aware that actions have tangible, physical, social consequences. In fact, their response is often more effective because it's not distorted by their own personal fear or defensive rage.
So the action flows from compassion, not personal reaction.
Precisely. Life is lived with equanimity, that internal stability, but also with clear-eyed responsibility. They respond to the reality of the situation as it is, seeing the interconnectedness, rather than reacting defensively to some imagined threat to themselves.
So let's define this ultimate goal, the state of no fear. If it isn't passive, what is it?
It's a radical stability. The state of no fear is not the elimination of your biological alarm bells. It's the ability to perceive life from a deep, fundamental ground of safety that just cannot be shaken by the constant flux of external circumstances.
True freedom is realizing that my identity is rooted in that unthreatened awareness, not in my vulnerable body or my fearful mind.
That sounds like the ultimate resilience. The promise isn't that the world will stop being chaotic, but that the center of your being will remain stable within the chaos.
That's it. We're always seeking refuge in external things. Money, relationships, status, and all of it is temporary. The real promise here is that our awareness itself is never threatened.
It's the space, the container in which everything arises and passes away. And when that recognition stabilizes, as Maharaj guaranteed, it is irreversible. Chronic fear, which is the result of a misperception, is no longer the defining lens through which you see life. What's left is simplicity, clarity, and an openness to life exactly as it is.
And this realization requires practice. The sources provide 5 specific practical steps for integrating this.
Yes, 5 steps that blend the ancient inquiry with modern physiological regulation. Let's walk the listener through these.
Yeah, I think it's important to frame these not as chores, but as opportunities to shift our default setting. Let's start with 1, sit in presence.
This is the non-negotiable core practice. Every day, just commit to a few minutes of quiet sitting. The key is just to feel the natural rhythm of your breath. Thoughts will come. Don't fight them. Just notice that simple sense of being. This is where the I am begins to reveal itself.
2, observe fear without resistance. When anxiety comes up, our instinct is to either push it down or get swept away by the story. What's the alternative?
The alternative is radical acceptance. Just notice the physical sensations of fear, the knot in your stomach, the tension in your shoulders. Allow those sensations to be there without reacting or labeling them. When you can hold the sensation with a welcoming awareness, you decouple the feeling from the narrative and you begin to dissolve the fear's control over you.
The fear is the sensation. The suffering is the resistance to it.
That's it. The 3rd step focuses on physical connection. Reconnect through gratitude and nature.
Chronic anxiety is a feeling of isolation.
So grounding your awareness and connection counters that directly. Spend time outside. Actively sense the continuity between your body and the living world. Gratitude is a powerful regulator because it shifts your focus from lack to abundance.
And the sources are really specific here. They recommend walking barefoot.
Literally connecting your body's electrical system to the earth. Or taking baths with Epsom or magnesium salts, which relaxes the whole system.
And they even had that anecdote about Paul McCartney walking barefoot on Abbey Road back in 69 to promote grounding. It's this old intuitive wisdom.
Exactly. It shows we've intuitively understood this connection between grounding and regulation for a long, long time.
Okay, 4, reflect before sleep. This is about preparing for future calm.
Each evening, just recall 1 moment of reactivity from your day. And gently, without judgment, imagine how that situation might have been met from a place of calm, steady awareness. You're not scolding yourself. You're planting a seed for a different response next time.
And finally, the 5th step. Remember, you belong.
Yes. Beyond all the noise, attend to the underlying wholeness of life. The sources emphasize this isn't just a feel-good phrase. It's the fundamental truth of non-duality. We are not aliens stranded on a dangerous planet. We're integral to the system. And accepting that is the beginning of sustained freedom.
These practices can be deepened with reflective inquiry. The sources give 5 prompts for journaling or meditation.
Yes, and these are designed to cut right through the story and apply the Upanishadic idea to your daily experience. The first is exploring fear and separation.
When fear comes up, you ask yourself, is this fear about a real event happening now or an imagined future? And then, crucially, who is the one that feels threatened? Does this trace back to a sense of being separate?
That challenges the foundational mistake in real time. The 2nd prompt is about recognizing wholeness in ordinary moments. Reflect on times you felt completely connected, maybe in nature or listening to a friend. How did fear just diminish in that state?
It gives your mind concrete evidence of non-separation.
Right. The 3rd is seeing cause and effect clearly. At the end of the day, review 1 choice you made and just observe its immediate consequence. This is cultivating awareness of practical karma, building clarity into your actions without the distortion of fear.
4, shifting from reactivity to presence. This is using visualization as preparation.
Visualize a recurring trigger, a difficult conversation, a moment of high pressure, and just imagine how the scenario would change if you approached it from that calm, steady, 4th state awareness. You're preparing your neural pathways for that moment.
And the final, deepest prompt, contemplating the question, who am I?
This is a direct gateway to the Nisargadatta Maharaj teaching. You sit quietly and repeat inwardly, who am I, before thought, before emotion. And the key instruction is, stay with the question, But don't look for an intellectual answer. Just allow awareness itself to reveal the stillness that's underneath all the changing experience.
Before we get to the Q&A, we have to pause on this insight from Albert Einstein, which really summarizes the psychological outcome of all of this.
Yes, the idea that the most important decision we make is whether we believe we live in a friendly or a hostile universe. This isn't a scientific calculation. It's a fundamental perceptual choice that determines your nervous system's default state.
If the universe is hostile, your nervous system stays on high alert, always defending. If it's fundamentally trustworthy, which is the non-dual view that we're inseparable from the whole, then relaxation and openness become possible.
And this perspective doesn't sugarcoat pain, it just reframes it. It suggests that painful events, while real, can be seen within a larger context of growth and learning, rather than as random, malevolent attacks on an isolated individual.
And the sources draw a compelling line from this individual work to collective safety.
This is the societal implication. A safer world isn't achieved by more defenses, but by more people relating to life from internal trust rather than chronic fear. Every time an individual practices meeting their own inner fear with understanding instead of aggression or avoidance, the world becomes incrementally less hostile. Personal transformation is collective safety work.
Okay, that brings us to our final segment. We've covered a lot of ground philosophy, ancient practice, modern neuroscience, practical application. Now, let's try to address some of the most common points of confusion and solidify all this in a kind of interview format.
Let's do it.
First question. How should we think about the medical versus the spiritual view of anxiety?
Well, the key is to hold both perspectives at the same time. Medically, anxiety is a heightened, dysregulated state of the autonomic nervous system. It shows up as cognitive worry and physical symptoms, and that requires physiological tools, sometimes even clinical help.
But spiritually?
Spiritually, anxiety is seen as a symptom of a deeper misperception, the feeling of being separate, vulnerable, and cut off from the ground of your own being. The non-dual teachings address this root cause by pointing to an underlying reality of unity and safety that isn't dependent on your circumstances. Both views are true, and both need attention.
Okay, let's just quickly reiterate the core difference between fear and anxiety in this context. It feels essential.
It is. Fear is the immediate functional response to a present identifiable threat. Anxiety is diffuse, chronic, and future-oriented. It's focused on possibilities.
And in the non-dual view.
Anxiety is basically seen as biological fear that has been hijacked and perpetuated by the imagination, fueled constantly by that cognitive sense of separation and uncertainty.
Next question. How does that quote, "where there is other, there is fear," actually show up in everyday life?
It shows up as constant psychological defense. If you perceive the world as separate from you, you are always on guard. This looks like intense comparison with your colleagues. It looks like defensiveness with your partner, a constant need for external validation.
Or just that debilitating feeling of being overwhelmed and alone against the world's pressures.
Exactly. The shift is replacing that posture of defense with an open, receptive state of non-separation.
This is a critical one. Does this emphasis on unity mean ignoring real-world problems like injustice or suffering? Is it just spiritual bypassing?
We have to be really careful here. Non-duality is a profound shift in perception and motivation, not a denial of objective reality.
Oh.
Recognizing a deeper unity doesn't erase injustice. It actually allows for clearer, more effective, and less defensive action. If your response to suffering isn't driven by your own personal fear or rage, it's far more likely to be compassionate and appropriate. The sources are explicit that you still have to honor the law of cause and effect, karma, in the social and ethical world.
And how does the science, specifically polyvagal theory, support the spiritual claim of no fear?
PVT gives us the neurological map. It demonstrates that our emotional and cognitive states are literally tied to our autonomic nervous system states. We're either in safety mode or defense mode.
And the spiritual practices.
The simple practices rooted in non-dual awareness, like being present with your breath or practicing non-reaction, are scientifically proven ways to shift the body out of the defensive fight-or-flight state and toward the safe and social state. The spiritual insight and the physiological technique are two sides of the same coin.
What if someone finds that these non-dual teachings actually trigger fear? The idea of no self can be really destabilizing.
That is a very genuine risk, and the advice here is crucial. Proceed slowly and ground yourself deeply. If the idea of no separate self feels terrifying, it means your system is interpreting a philosophical challenge as a physical threat.
So what should you do?
Anchor your practice in physiological safety first. Just focus on body-based grounding, slow, regulated breathing, gentle presence. Treat the fear that comes up not as a philosophical problem to solve, but as a physical sensation to be gently felt and welcomed. You allow the nervous system to stay regulated while the understanding slowly integrates.
Let's go back to internal separation. How do inner conflicts fit into the idea of no other, no fear?
Well, our inner conflicts are just a reflection of that larger principle. Our internal parts, the inner critic, the driver, the child, they act as internal others battling for control, and that generates intense anxiety.
In methods like voice dialogue or Big Mind.
They provide the process for integration. They help you recognize these fragments not as enemies, but as necessary, though maybe immature, expressions of one underlying wholeness. When the larger non-dual awareness of Big Mind can hold these parts, the internal threat dissipates. They can cooperate instead of competing.
So it's one thing to address existential fear, but can this spacious awareness really help with everyday stress?
Yeah.
You know, crushing work deadlines, family pressure.
Absolutely, profoundly. But the shift is subtle. Non-duality doesn't make the deadlines disappear, but it changes the felt sense of who is carrying the burden.
Can you explain that?
When a challenge arises within spacious awareness, it's just an event. A deadline exists. When it's carried by the contracted me, it feels like an attack on my existence. The non-dual perspective makes stress more workable because it shifts your locus of identity, and it combines that spaciousness with practical nervous system regulation to manage the physiological pressure spike.
So if the goal is a state of no fear, is the objective to get rid of functional biological fear completely?
No, that would be dangerous and impossible. Functional fear, the appropriate response to a genuine immediate threat like that bus, is essential for survival.
So what's the aim?
The goal is to end the unnecessary psychological fear and the chronic background anxiety that result from the misperception of separation. We want to return fear to its proper role as an occasional, helpful signal, not let it define our entire inner climate.
Okay, last question. If a listener feels overwhelmed by all this, where is the gentlest, simplest place to start?
The advice is always consistent. Start small, start gentle, and combine the body and the inquiry. Begin with just a few minutes of simple breath-focused awareness to stabilize your system. Simultaneously, introduce simple body-based grounding. Feel your weight, feel your feet on the floor.
And the inquiry.
Alongside that, just gently introduce the quiet question. Who is aware of this experience? That dual approach builds both physiological stability and the taste of a wider, unthreatened awareness. So to summarize this whole journey, we've seen that the crisis of modern anxiety really finds its root in that ancient conceptual mistake of separation of the other. And the profound truth of non-duality, which is now being validated by things like polyvagal theory, offers an irreversible path out.
When you recognize that fear and anxiety just can't survive in the light of the awareness that you're inseparable from the life you're living,
clarity, connection, and peace are the natural result.
And what really stands out to me is the shift in focus. We spend so much energy trying to escape our own vulnerability, trying to find security out there in the world. But the path to freedom lies in recognizing that our awareness itself is never threatened.
It's the inherent fundamental stability that we were looking for all along.
It truly is a paradigm shift from a life of frantic defense to a life of responsive clarity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you move back into your day, managing all the pressures of modern life will leave you with this challenge, drawn directly from the reflective wisdom we've explored today. Notice your recurring anxieties. Observe them without judgment. Allow the physical sensations to be there and ask yourself this one profound question. Is this fear a response to a current physical reality, or is it a byproduct of my feeling of being separate?
The understanding that arises from that simple, honest observation is the key to lasting peace. Until the next deep dive, thank you for joining us.